We come to the end then, as I've said, in our studies, our sermons in this book of Ezekiel, and we come then to these last nine chapters, which form the thrilling climax to the book. This then is the grand finale, the wonderful conclusion to this book. Now, I'm not joking when I say this. This really is the great conclusion, the grand climax to the book. This is wonderful and uplifting stuff. But of course, I say it knowing that these last nine chapters of Ezekiel don't normally strike us in that way, that if you are someone who reads through the Bible on a regular basis and you're doing your Bible reading plan, then I suspect these last nine chapters of Ezekiel probably compete with the first 10 chapters of 1 Chronicles in terms of the chapters that you find least gripping and least want to turn to and read then in your Bible reading plan. But they are truly a wonderful portion of Scripture. And of course, our problem is that we don't see that. We don't understand what this is about for several reasons. But in summary, what Ezekiel gives us here is his vision of heaven. This is Ezekiel's vision of heaven. Now, of course, it's not heaven as you would normally understand it at all. But this is heaven that the Lord is presenting to his prophet Ezekiel, to the Jews of Ezekiel's day. And I hope that by the end of our worship this evening, you will be able to see that that is the case, and to be able to see that indeed this is wonderful teaching that Ezekiel is bringing, or was given by the Lord through this series of visions. But to begin with then, just to orientate ourselves to these chapters, I want to make 5 introductory comments to help us to kind of approach, to read, to interpret this portion of Scripture properly. First of all then, the whole book of Ezekiel is intensely personal, isn't it? We've been through the book. It's an amazing book because it's all about the Lord's intense dealings with this man in a one-to-one way. Ezekiel's given us 50 oracles in this book. 48 of them begin with, "The word of the Lord came to me." The whole book, virtually, almost every word in the book is in the first person. It's the Lord and Ezekiel between them. It's not like so many of the prophets, in the third person. And we've seen then that this book has a series of these visions when Ezekiel is lifted up and is given these amazing experiences by God, when he falls down on his face, as he does again here, because he is brought into the glorious presence of the Lord, when he's gripped by the Spirit of God. He's given sign acts to perform. He is given then an intensely personal set of revelations that he's recorded for us in this book. And these last chapters are very much in line then with that intensely personal nature of this experience. And this is particularly so because remember, Ezekiel was a priest. We saw back at the beginning of the book, Ezekiel was a priest. But a priest had been taken into exile when he was about 25, before he could ever serve in the temple of God. He had been raised then to serve in God's temple. As a man of God, he had wanted to be there in the house of God, having that privilege then of leading the Lord's people in worship there in Jerusalem at the temple of God. But he'd never had the chance. But now the Lord then gives him these visions. And he says, "Here then, Ezekiel, is a temple. Don't worry, there will be a temple again, Ezekiel. And you will minister there." And one of the most moving sections in the book is at the end of chapter 43, where Ezekiel is told that he will offer sacrifices to consecrate this temple of God. Amazing. That would have been so wonderful for him, wouldn't it? Yes, Ezekiel, you will one day at last have your heart's desire met. You will be able to worship me there in this future temple as you have desired to do. This was an intensely personal book, and we need to, I think, understand that as we come to these chapters. But related to what I've just said then is the fact that these final chapters are then the final in a series of visions that we've been considering these past weeks, or rather a series of future-oriented prophecies, aren't they? From chapter 34 onwards, we've seen that Ezekiel is given amazing prophecies of a future restored people of God. He is talked then, as we've seen, about this great King Shepherd, someone who would come to bring justice to the people of God, someone who would rule over them as a true Messiah, the son of David, a great king, who would amazingly be the Lord himself dwelling amongst his people. We saw that he would then rule over and shepherd these people in a restored land of Israel, a land that was so blessed that the hills were flowing, as it were, with crops and with trees, that this was a richly blessed land, a land where the people of God would be united together, a land which would not merely be for the people of the future, but all God's people in the past be raised up to join as a worshipping people of God. This was a people of God then who would truly worship God. This was a people we saw in chapter 36 whose hearts would be regenerated, softened by the people of God. They would be made worshippers of God. They would be those who would be cleansed by the Spirit of God. But there was something missing, wasn't there? Now, as Christians, we might miss what was missing in those first chapters. I commented a couple of weeks ago that in chapter 37, we have for the first time mentioned that there will be a sanctuary in the future. But this was a greater mission, particularly for Ezekiel as a priest, you see. He's had this great vision. There's going to be a king, there's going to be a land, there's going to be a blessed land with a united people, regenerated and serving God, cleansed and purified. But what about Jerusalem? What about a temple? Is there going to be a temple? Is there going to be a city of God there? Where were we going to worship God in this place in the future? These then are huge omissions. And these last chapters then address those gaps, as Ezekiel is given then this vision, or these visions, of a future temple and city in the land. And as I say, that has special meaning for him as a priest of God. Now, I know in the congregation here there are a few people who are very interested in trains and engines, who enjoy their train spotting. And many of us can't quite get our heads around that. We can't quite understand what people who enjoy looking at engines and doing train spotting, what it's all about. We're kind of mystified. This just seems so kind of pointless. But for people who like that, then it's thrilling. They will go down, they will look at the engines, they will note numbers down and things, and they'll be really thrilled at the details of this engine compared with that engine and so on. And you see, Ezekiel's a priest, as I've said. He wanted to worship in the temple of God. So when this mysterious figure with a measuring rod comes around in the temple and says, measures this, and he measures that wall, and he measures these steps and this doorway, Ezekiel was thrilled. He was a priest. This is what he was really interested in. He'd wanted to be in the temple of God. This really meant something to him. It might not thrill us in quite the same way, but it meant something really to him, in that same kind of way that people who like trains enjoy the details. Well, he liked. I'm sure he was thrilled by these details in this vision. So this was intensely personal, and it's the final climactic visions in the series of visions, and it fills in what was missing. It's of a temple and a city in the land. But then thirdly, this of course has never been built, has it? This temple has never been built. And more importantly, this temple never will be built by man. There never will be an architectural structure. There never will be a material object like Ezekiel describes here. We know that from within these chapters. For example, Ezekiel is never commanded to build this. Now that's in contrast, you remember, to Moses. When Moses went up the mountain and was shown what he was to build, then he was said, he was told time and again, wasn't he? See that you make it according to the pattern on the mountain. You read those chapters in Exodus, time after time. Moses, do it just as you've seen it on the mountain. Because he was to build that tabernacle. And Solomon later similarly was to build that temple. But Ezekiel, no one was ever meant to build this. No man was to make this. God will make it, as we'll see. But no man was to make this temple. That's why we don't have enough details, actually, if you read through this. We're given virtually no vertical dimensions to this temple at all. It wouldn't be possible, actually, to build it for that reason. Nor are we given anything of the materials from which it was to be built. Another major omission if you were going to try to construct this temple. You know, we're not told where it's to be built from. But we were, of course, with the temple and the tabernacle. We were told in detail what they were to be made of. So these things show us that this temple vision, or the series of visions, was never meant to be implemented. So fourthly then, the Lord in giving these visions was speaking then to Ezekiel in language and concepts that he could understand, wasn't he? I've said it's a vision of heaven, or a series of visions of heaven. Now, he couldn't come to Ezekiel and speak in kind of New Testament language. He had to speak in a way that Ezekiel and the Jews of Ezekiel's day could understand. So he had to speak in the language of the Old Covenant. He had to speak in the language of sacrifices, of temples with their rooms and doors and altars and so on. Because that's what he could understand. That's what he could get hold of. It would be meaningless to speak in the language of Jesus Christ and a fulfilled sacrifice by him, because Ezekiel wouldn't have known what he was talking about. Just as with all the Old Testament prophets, he had to speak in the language of the day, even though through that language he was speaking of something in the great future. And so fifthly and briefly again, Ezekiel then in this series of visions is giving something that is to be interpreted figuratively or symbolically. I've said it's not to be built, no man will ever build this, and so on. And it's because what we have here is visions which are to be interpreted by their symbolism. Just as we've seen earlier in the book, haven't we? Even right at the beginning of the book, when the Lord's glory appears. Now that isn't really, as it were, the Lord. It's a representation in sign language, in symbols. Or when Ezekiel has his temple visions in chapters 8 to 11 of the old temple that was to be destroyed. He wasn't seeing something as it was literally happening. He was being taught something through the pictures that he was communicating to us. Or as we've seen in these later chapters of the book, the dry bones, Gog and Magog and so on. These are pictures to be interpreted by their symbols, not to be interpreted literally. Most obviously in these final chapters with a great river flowing out. You can't have a river as described. It's got no tributaries, yet it gets deeper and wider and so on. You can't have a river like that because it flows from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea over hills and mountains. It's geographically impossible to do that. Because, of course, it's not meant to be just as it's described. It's a symbol, as we'll see later on. So in reading then these chapters, we need to see them as given to Ezekiel as a priest, as a man of God, in language of his day. That the Lord is communicating then using that Old Testament symbolism and the language of the temple and so on to teach Ezekiel about a marvellous heavenly future for the people of God. And so then coming to the chapters themselves. These nine chapters we can divide into sort of three major themes or three major parts. The new temple, the new worship, and the new land. The new temple, the new worship, and the new land. And we'll obviously move very quickly through these, particularly the second two sections. But first of all then, the new temple. So what most of us know about this is this future temple vision. And Ezekiel's given a kind of 3D virtual reality tour. Now, not all of us, but some of us, particularly the younger members of the congregation, are used to sort of video games and Xbox and these kinds of things. And you play these games, and some of you may have seen these screens where you see these kinds of these buildings and these tunnels and these mazes on these computer-generated images for the games. And people move through, and you see you're kind of carried through all these different rooms and passageways and corridors. And Ezekiel's experience in the temple was something like that. He's taken up in a vision and he's led through and he's shown then on this kind of virtual reality tour all these different rooms, the entrances and the exits, the altars and the temple itself. What he sees then is, first of all, a huge outer wall. A massive outer wall. It's very thick and long and large. We won't bother with the details, the dimensions. It's got a gate on the north, a gate on the east, and a gate on the south. They're all the same size. Inside that outer wall is the outer court. And it is another thick wall, the inner wall. And again, it's got a large gateway on the north and on the east and on the south. And that leads through then again to the inner courtyard. And within the inner courtyard, he sees a massive altar. It's a huge altar, about 34 feet square, massive altar. Behind that, he sees the temple itself. And then behind that, there's another massive building that's function isn't clear. Within then, the inner courtyard. And the language then that we have in describing all of this emphasizes the security, the everlastingness, and the holiness of these buildings, or this building, the temple, and the courtyards around it, the temple complex. The security, the whole business about measuring, this chap with his measuring rod going round, that's to say this is going to last. It was a way in the language of the day of saying you're measuring something, it's secure. This is not going to be demolished, Ezekiel. Solomon's temple, yes, that's been destroyed, but this one will never be destroyed. These gates, these doors and so on, these will last forever. It will be safe and secure. It will be a temple that cannot be demolished. And this is emphasized by the thickness that I've commented on of all the walls and so on. These are massively thick because then it was to be secure. But also then the holiness is emphasized by the fact that as you go from the outside inwards, you go upwards and upwards through a series of steps, higher and higher, and the entrances get narrower and narrower, emphasizing then the holiness, that it gets more and more difficult as you go further inwards. This place was to be holy. And of course, it's emphasized by the fact that the Lord himself comes to fill this place with his glory, as we read. The Lord's glory, remember, back in chapter 10, had departed through the east gate of the old temple in that vision there. Now he returns. Ezekiel emphasizes the Lord, the same Lord, the same glorious God. He's returning now to dwell. But this one he will stay in forever, says Ezekiel. And his glory, he says, fills this temple. But there are some peculiarities, right? There are a lot of peculiarities about all these visions, but start with the temple. There are major omissions here when you read. Most significantly, there is no Ark of the Covenant. There's no Ark of the Covenant. And in fact, there's no most holy place at all that you can find as you were used to finding in the tabernacle or the Solomonic temple. And in fact, there's no candlestick. There's no bread of the presence. There's no golden altar of incense. There's no curtain. There's no veil then to wall off or to separate a most holy place from a holy place. These things you would expect, Ezekiel would have expected these to be there, but they're not there. Why not? Why are these things absent? Well, what's happening, it seems, is that the barriers of separation are being broken down. You remember the old covenant structures then in the tabernacle and the temple, they emphasized the separation of the Lord from everybody else. He dwelled on his throne, as it were, in the most holy place, on the Ark of the Covenant. That's where his footstool on earth was. That's where his throne on earth was, where his glory most fully dwelt. But that was behind the curtain. And then there was his outer room, and that's walled off from from the rest of the temple complex, which is walled off from the rest of the city of Jerusalem. And the city of Jerusalem is more holy than the Holy Land. And that's a clean and a holy place than the rest of planet Earth. But planet Earth, of course, is itself separated from heaven. There's a series of barriers and zones of cleanliness and holiness. But these things in Ezekiel's temple are disappearing. The temple furniture is gone. Where is the holy place and the most holy place? Why is there no ark? Where is the Lord going to reign? In chapter 43 and verse 12, we read, "This is the law of the temple. All the surrounding area on top of the mountain will be most holy. Such is the law of the temple." Now, when the glory of the Lord has filled the temple, he's filled the whole temple. The whole temple seems to become a most holy place. That's not certain at all from that, because he filled the other ones to start with in a similar way. But here we read that the whole of the top of the mountain, not just the whole of the temple, the whole of the area around it has now become most holy. It all seems to become like the most holy place, where the Lord dwells in that fullest way on earth. But more than that, we have the final words of the book, don't we? The famous final words. "The name of that city from that time on will be the Lord is there." There's a funny twist. I said Ezekiel's a twisty prophet. There's a twist. The temple isn't in the city. When you read through this, if you read through in detail, you find the temple actually isn't in the city at all. The temple is located several miles north of the city. It's a surprise, isn't it? The temple isn't in the city. So we have the city, but the city is described of, in language that seems to suggest, it's the ordinary place where the future Israel was going to live. And yet it is there that we read that the name will be "the Lord is there." What we would expect of the holiest of all places, the inner sanctuary, is true of this city, even though it's not, the temple isn't there at all. So not only does the Lord's glorious presence seem to have gone out beyond the most holy place, throughout the whole temple area and beyond, he seems to have gone out, as it were, further into the city, miles and miles beyond. There is a great breaking down of the boundaries and the restrictions in this vision that Ezekiel gives. These are things that Ezekiel and the Jews would have noticed, and it would have perplexed them. But they indicate something that Ezekiel was not alone in teaching. So, for example, we read in Jeremiah verse 16. Jeremiah 3, verse 16. Jeremiah looks to a future period like this, and he says, "In those days, when your numbers have increased greatly in the land, declares the Lord, men will no longer say, 'The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord.' It will never enter their minds or be remembered. It will not be missed, nor will another one be made." Jeremiah sees a time when there will be no ark. He says instead, "At that time, they will call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord." The whole of Jerusalem, then, he says, is going to be like the most holy place where the Lord dwelt. He too pictures a time when the barriers that separated the Lord from his people are being demolished. And what Ezekiel then pictures in his temple, here in the temple complex, is an access to the presence of God that the Old Covenant saints never enjoyed. They had all these barriers separating them, all these priestly regulations and the rules of cleanliness, but not so in this future. This future, there will be an openness for the people of God to come to his presence. There will be an access that this future people of God can enjoy to the presence of the Lord of glory himself that is beyond, I think, would have been beyond the comprehension of Ezekiel and the people of his day. How can this be? How can the people of God enjoy such privileges in worship? He will no longer be hidden away in a little room in the back of the temple. He will be there. The Lord will be there. The name of the city will be "The Lord is there." And we can go there and we can worship him. It's a tremendously uplifting vision, you see, for Ezekiel, isn't it? A tremendously uplifting vision of the future that He desired to worship in the temple of God. And the Lord said, you will. And you, Ezekiel, and all you other Jews who are faithful to me, you will enjoy something much greater than your heart desires. Something much greater than your minds can conceive. You will enjoy an access to me that no saint before has ever enjoyed. So the new temple then is this secure and safe and everlasting place. But a place where the saints, the people of God, will enjoy unprecedented access to the Lord of glory in worship. And then there will be then the new worship of God. The new worship of God then that Ezekiel describes in chapters 43 to 46. And in these chapters then, Ezekiel describes a whole new set of sacrifices, burnt offerings, sin offerings and so on. The new altar, a whole new calendar for worship. What we have, in fact, is a mini Pentateuch. Because Ezekiel here is functioning as a new Moses. If you do biblical trivial pursuits, the only place outside the Pentateuch where you have law given is in these chapters in Ezekiel. Here, Ezekiel, as a new Moses, is given a whole new set of legislation for this future Israel. Now, we could spend a long time going through the details of all this legislation, and I'm obviously not going to do that. But the point is that when you read it all, everything, almost everything, all the sacrifice and the calendar and everything is different from Moses' system. For that reason, the Jews didn't like these chapters. They said, how can this prophet disagree with Moses? How can he have a system that's different from Moses? Well, it was all different from Moses. But I think the reason for that is what we've already seen. This was never meant to happen literally at all. There was never going to be a Jew who actually had to do something that was different from Moses, who never had to offer a sacrifice that disagreed with the law of Moses. So we have a whole new worship system given, but a worship system that is different throughout from that given by Moses, to indicate that there will be a new way of worship in this future that will be different from Moses. We know much greater than that Moses gave. And then thirdly, the new land, which is described partly in chapter 45 and then in more detail in chapters 47 and 48. Ezekiel pictures a new land, and he pictures the new land as a series of parallel strips, which he describes running from north to south. There are 13 parallel strips, one parallel strip for each tribe, each of the 12 tribes. There are 7 of them described running parallel from north to south. And then the 8th strip is the sacred area where the temple and the city would be, and where the prince would be, and where the Levites would be. And then there were the 5 other tribes with their strips to the south. And the way the geography described is again making it very clear this was not meant to be literally carried out. These parallel strips would have been difficult to conduct or to make happen in reality in this world, but they were never meant to be. And this land then, this new land, the parallel strips through it emphasise the justice of God. This would be a fair place. This would be somewhere that all the tribes were treated equally. They all had the same sized portions of land, as it were. And it would be a place that was purified and blessed abundantly by the Lord. That's the point of the river, isn't it? The river flows out from the temple. And we read that not only, of course, does it get wider and deeper as it goes, miraculously, but it purifies wherever it goes. It purifies the Dead Sea so that it can be filled with all kinds of fish and so on. But along its banks, there are these trees. Trees then producing bountiful fruit. Trees which have their leaves that bring healing, because this will be a place, this land will be cleansed by this river, and it will be a life then that is granted life by the river. This is the river, of course, of the water of life, the river that brings life to the land, a land overflowing then with the life of God, where there will be healing and blessing and so on. So he sees then a new land, cleansed, purified, made bountiful by the river of life coming out from the Lord, the source of life, in his temple. a land then fairly and equally divided, emphasising the justice of God. So we have then these three major elements or themes through these chapters. The new temple, where the barriers are broken down and access to God is granted in an amazing new way. We have a whole new system of worship presented. And we have a new land which is pure and blessed with abundance of life. So when, how is this fulfilled? Well, I've said already that this is a vision of heaven. And once again, I can happily say that this is not my interpretation. Just as I said last week that we have an apostle who can tell us what this means in the future. We have the same apostle telling us what this means for us in the future. Because again, we can turn to the book of Revelation. We can turn to the book of Revelation, the final vision that John gives us at the end of the book of Revelation. From chapter 21, verse 1 to chapter 22, verse 5. Here John then says, this is the fulfilment of Ezekiel 40 to 48. John's vision here is a fulfilment. He's saying this is what's fulfilling Ezekiel's temple vision in chapters 40 to 48. We see that for several reasons. I'll just give you a few examples. In Revelation 21 and verse 10, we read then that he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. So he sees then the holy city, this future temple city. He sees it descending from heaven. But he sees it then as situated on a mountain great and high. And what do we read of at the beginning of Ezekiel 40? Ezekiel is taken in a vision to see the city on a very high mountain. John is saying, this is what Ezekiel was talking about. Or again, in this vision that John has in Revelation 21, we read in verse 15 of a figure with a measuring rod who's going around measuring the city. Again, drawn, as we've seen, from Ezekiel 40 to 48, where we read, particularly in the first few chapters, of this figure with a measuring rod. Or again, we read at the end of Revelation 21, verses 12 and 13, sorry, not at the end, in verses 12 and 13, that there will be three gates on the north, three on the south, three on the east, three on the west, in this city. Of course, that's just like we read at the end of Ezekiel 48, isn't it? This city has three gates on the north, south, east and west. And most obviously, we have then in Revelation 22, the beginning of Revelation 22, in this vision, John talking about the river of the water of life. The angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. And on each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. Very obviously drawn then from what we've read of in Ezekiel 40 to 48. So by this, John is saying, dotted throughout this in these ways, he's saying, what I'm talking of here is what Ezekiel was talking of at the end of his book. And we're not surprised, are we? Because we saw last week that the Gog and Magog prophecies in Ezekiel 38 and 39, John tells us they are fulfilled, as we read of in chapters 19 and 20 of the book of Revelation, that Jesus Christ will return to defeat this assault on his people in the tribulatory period. He will deliver his people with that marvellous victory because they will be secure forever. There will be the final judgment. And following that is this vision that he gives us, isn't it, of the new heavens and the new earth. But the point in all of this is that this new heavens and the new earth are the dwelling place finally of God with his people, aren't they? That's what binds all this together. Is this is the final brilliant vision that the Lord gives us of his dwelling with his people in glory forever and ever. So chapter 21, John says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth. But then he says in verse 2, I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride dressed for her husband. So the new heaven and the new earth is the same as the holy city. It's the same as the bride. This is what he sees. It's the same thing, as it were. But then as we move forward to verse 9, John says, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. The holy city then that he sees is the temp, is the place where God dwells. It's the bride. It's the new heaven and the new earth. It's then the place where the Lord will meet and dwell forever with his people. And I just want to draw three points that John draws from Ezekiel as he pictures this final heavenly state for the people of God. Three main points. Firstly, that heaven, as John describes it based on Ezekiel, is the new Eden. Heaven is Eden restored, isn't it? Heaven is Eden restored. We saw back in chapter 36 of Ezekiel, remember, he pictures the final state in the new land as Eden restored. And so it's the same here, because dotted throughout the descriptions of a temple, we have the descriptions of palm trees on the walls and the doors and so on. And we have the pictures of cherubim on the walls and the doors and so on. Now, why is that? Well, they were, of course, in the tabernacle, weren't they? And they were in the temple. They too were adorned with pictures of trees and pictures of angels. And the reason for that is because they come from the Garden of Eden. Eden was the place where the Lord dwelt with man. Eden was the original tabernacle or temple where God dwelt with man, where there were trees, where there were angels, because it was heaven on earth where the Lord dwelt with his people, where his people enjoyed unbroken access to his presence, or Adam did anyway, enjoyed unbroken access to the Lord there. It was, of course, the place with the river, wasn't it? It was a place where the river flows out from Eden, or into Eden, then four rivers flow out from Eden, just as we have the river here, the river in the final Eden, flowing forth to bring healing and cleansing and so on. So the language then, the pictures of the cherubim and the palm trees, is to say this is going to be the final dwelling place of God with men. This will be Eden restored, the paradise temple at last again established on earth. John draws the same language then as he pictures the river with the trees and so on. It's from Eden, the place with the river and the trees. So the vision of Ezekiel is then for a restored Eden, where man and God would dwell together in this final dwelling place. But secondly then, The vision that John gives us is of then a temple. It's a final temple. We read then in Revelation 21, as he said, he shows me in verse 10 of 21, Revelation 21, I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down, and he describes it. And then in verse 15, the angel measures it. And verse 16, he measures it, and it's 12,000 stadia in length, and as wide and high as it's long. In other words, what he measures is a massive cube, hundreds of miles on each side, a huge cube. Now, this isn't because Jesus is going to marry a huge cube, but the bride of the Lamb, the future city, is described here as a massive cube. And remember that the bride, the city, is the new universe. It is the new heaven and the new earth that he's seeing. So John says, I saw the new heaven and the new earth. It's like a city. It's like the bride of the Lamb. It's like a huge cube. Why a huge cube? Because the most holy place was the cube, wasn't it? It was the cubic place where the throne of God was. Because we saw in Ezekiel, remember, that all the barriers were being broken down. That there was no longer then a clear delineation between the most holy place and the rest of the temple, or even between the temple and the area surrounding it and the whole city. The Lord's glory, his presence is bursting forth in this future era. And in fact, John then takes this to the ultimate, doesn't he? He says the whole future universe is going to be a most holy place. The whole future universe is going to be filled with the glory of God. That's what he says anyway, directly, isn't it? The city doesn't need a sun or the moon, for the glory of God gives its light. He says in verse 11, the whole city shone with the glory of God. He says in verse 22, I didn't see a temple, that is a physical temple, a material structure, in this city. Why? Because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. Everywhere in this future city temple, everywhere in this future heavens and earth, will be the glory of God. No barriers, no veils, no separation between the people of God and his beautiful dwelling amongst us. Wherever you are in this future universe, wherever you are on the restored Eden, there will the Lord be. I don't know how that will work. I don't know how that will work, but that's what he says. There will be no distinctions now. No need to travel anywhere, because all will be the holiest of all. All will be filled in the most consummate and final way with the glory of our God in Jesus Christ. He is the temple and he is everywhere. And finally then, thirdly then, this future glory that Ezekiel is picturing, this future heaven, which is a restored Eden, which is all the holiest place of all in the temple, is open to all nations. It's open to all nations, isn't it? Because that's how John transforms Ezekiel's vision. Ezekiel's described then, for example, the river flowing, the trees along. He just says they're for healing. But what does John add? John says they're for the healing of the nations. No longer will this future people be only Jews. They will be all the nations, says John. This is, of course, consistent with everything we know of the New Testament. But John is saying Ezekiel was seeing this. Ezekiel was seeing this future beautiful state where people from all nations, where he can say the kings of the earth and people of nations will come through these gates. Those unclean ones in the old covenant era who weren't able to enter, they will all be able to come in. All the nations will enjoy this privilege of unbroken, constant access to the glorious presence of God. So this is Ezekiel's future vision in chapters 40 to 48. I hope you can see now why I said it is a great climax to his book. He sees then what John then develops at the end of his book. He sees then in this symbolic language, the final state, heaven, where we will enjoy, because of the work of Jesus Christ, unbroken access to God. Just one final point to make. People often say about these chapters, but what about the sacrifices? There's all this stuff in there about the altar, the bulls, all that calendar. How does all that work? Well, whatever your interpretation of these chapters, you've got a problem with the sacrifices, haven't you, as a Christian? Because this hasn't happened on anybody's interpretation. And of course, Hebrews and Jesus himself make it very clear that he's offered the once for all sacrifice. It is finished, that there are no more sacrifices. So how can Ezekiel be shown making sacrifices in what I've said is heaven? Well, I'm indebted to Greg Beale for a lot of what I've been saying, an American theologian, but also for this illustration to help us to understand this. He says, imagine a boy of perhaps 8, and he's sort of thinking about his future, and it's about 1900, and he's looking out, he's walking with his father one day, and he sees, you know, the horses and the carriages coming past, and the pony traps, and he says, "Oh, Dad, I'd really love a horse and carriage, you know, of our own, of my own." And so his dad says to him, "One day I'll buy you one. I'll get you a horse and carriage one day. Look, I tell you what, when you're married, when you're grown up and you're married, on your wedding day, your wedding present from me will be a horse and a carriage." Great, he thinks. On my wedding day, I'll get my horse and my carriage. And so we spin forwards 20 years or so. It's the 1920s. It's his wedding day. He's now grown up. It's his wedding day. And his father comes to him and says, "I've got you the wedding present I promised." And what does he give him? Well, he gives him a motor car. He gives him a motor car. Because, of course, the motor car has superseded the horse and carriage, hasn't it? The horse and carriage has been made redundant. It's passed into history. The motor car now fulfills everything that the horse and carriage used to do for transport. Now, does the son say, "But Dad, you told me you'd give me a horse and carriage, and all you've given me is a motor car"? Of course he doesn't. He's thrilled. He's got something much better than a horse and carriage, hasn't he? And Ezekiel won't be in heaven saying, "I want a lamb and a knife. Give me a bull to slaughter." Ezekiel will be amazed at the work of Jesus Christ. Ezekiel will be amazed at how all these old covenant things he's talked about have been fulfilled and surpassed by the work of Jesus Christ. We now serve the Lord as priests, offering ourselves as living sacrifices. We bring our praise and worship, which is incense rising to God in heaven. And in the final state, we're all made king priests. We'll all be there, living lives of devotion and service of God, fulfilling everything that those sacrifices and the calendars and everything was about. All those things will have passed away. John doesn't mention them in his vision because they've gone. They've been fulfilled by the Lamb himself. So everything that Ezekiel spoke of in these chapters has been wonderfully fulfilled by our Lord Jesus Christ. He has brought in this final wonderful state. He's made it available for us all, for people like us from nations all over the planet who can gather and worship at a time like this and look forward to a time of unbroken access to God. Everywhere we go in heaven, the Lord is there. Amen. We'll close then with number 861. I know we've sung it before, but it's a great hymn and a final wonderful hymn looking forward to our future state in heaven. Number 861, "The Sands of Time Are Sinking."